Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, Dorothy Gundy, Phil Dierking, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Susan Shand.
In a rural area in northern Yemen, many families with starving children have nothing to eat but the leaves of a local plant. They cook the leaves in water, creating a bitter, sharp-tasting green substance. International aid agencies have been surprised by the level of starvation in northern Yemen as parents and children die. Many thin children stopped by the main health center in Aslam during a recent visit by the Associated Press. Babies with all the signs of malnutrition were each weighed. Their papery skin was stretched tight over arms and legs. At least 20 children are known to have died of starvation in the province this year, more than 3 years into Yemen's civil war. The real number is likely higher, since few families report it when their children die at home, officials say. In a nearby village, a 7-month-old girl, Sahra, cries for her mother to feed her. Her mother is starving herself and is often unable to breastfeed the child. "Since the day she was born, I have not had the money to buy her milk or buy her medicine," the mother said. Sahra was recently treated at the health clinic. At home, she is losing weight again. Her parents do not have the money to pay for transportation back to the doctors. "If they don't, Sahra will die," said Makia Mahdi, the head of the clinic. "We are in the 21st century, but this is what the war did to us," she said. Mahdi added that after she visits nearby villages and sees people eating the green, leafy paste, "I go home and I can't put food in my mouth." The hunger in Aslam is a sign of problems in an international aid system that is already low on supplies and under pressure from local officials. Yet foreign aid is the only thing stopping widespread death from starvation in Yemen. The conditions in Aslam may also show that the aid agency's warnings are coming true. In an unending war, the spread of starvation is greater than the efforts to keep people alive.
When the Associated Press asked United Nations agencies about the situation in Aslam, they expressed surprise. To find out the reason why food was not getting to the needy families, aid groups launched an investigation, a top aid official told the AP. "In order to help immediately," the official said, "aid agencies are sending over 10,000 food containers to the area." The official did not give his name because of the danger of working in the middle of a war. UNICEF resident representative Maritzel Relaino said the organization is increasing its mobile teams from 3 to 4 and transporting people to the health clinics. In the first 6 months of 2018, Haja Province, including Aslam Village, had 17,000 cases of extreme malnutrition. That number is higher than any other year, said Waleed Al-Shamshan, head of nutrition at the province's health ministry. Malnourished children who are treated often go back to villages with no food and bad water. Then they return to clinics in worse condition or they die. Death happens in these villages where people can't reach healthcare teams, Al-Shamshan said. The civil war in Yemen has wrecked the country's ability to feed its people. The war is between Shiite Muslim rebels, known as Houthis, who hold the north, and a Saudi-led coalition, armed and helped by the United States. The coalition has tried to bomb the rebels into submission with an air campaign in support of Yemeni government forces.
Around 2.9 million women and children are acutely malnourished. Another 400,000 children with extreme malnourishment are fighting for their lives. Nearly 8.4 million of Yemen's 29 million people would starve without food aid, one-fourth more than last year, the UN estimates. That number is likely to rise by another 3.5 million because of the falling value of Yemen's money, which leaves people unable to buy food, the UN warned. To date, the UN and its partners have only received about 65% of the $3 billion they requested for a humanitarian campaign in 2018. Aid workers are also worried about an attack by Saudi-led forces on the Houthi-held Red Sea port of Hodeida. Most of the food aid comes through that city. I'm Susan Shand.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Jonathan Bethany uses his experiences in West Africa and other places to bring the ancient art of bread making to Washington, D.C. His bakery, Seilu, is different from most bakeries around the country. Bakers there grind whole grains in their own mill. They also buy their grains from local farmers. More than 15 years ago, Bethany visited Senegal to learn West African drumming. During his time living in a small desert village, he became interested in working with local farmers. He wanted to help local people who were struggling to get enough food. When he came back to the U.S., Bethany began working in restaurants and discovered a love for baking. Later, Bethany started working for the Washington State University's Bread Lab. There, he developed new ways of using many kinds of locally grown wheat without wasting any of their components. For Bethany, having his own bakery was the next step in using the skills he had learned and developed over many years. In November, he opened his bakery and called it Seilu, which means eagle in the West African language of Mandinka. At Seilu, it is important to use local ingredients. They get all of their grain fresh from local farmers. Bethany uses about 20 different kinds of organic grains in making his bread. He said, "We use several varieties of wheat alone and about 3 different ryes. Our mission here is to use what we call underutilized grains, which is important to grow in the organic system." Bethany adds that a lot of the soil in the area has been damaged from growing tobacco. He said growing millet helps bring life back to the soil. Bethany is one of only a small number of bakers around the United States who mill their grains on site, meaning at the bakery. This has caught the attention of food and environment reporter Sam Fromarts, who has written a book about bread called In Search of the Perfect Loaf. He says knowing how to mill and knowing which grains to use is what gives each kind of bread its individual taste and feel. Fromart said, "When you start baking with grains from particular farmers, the grains will be different in each farm. So Jonathan, in a sense, is adjusting each batch of grain that he mills. So he's kind of mixing and matching and playing with his ingredients." He said that Bethany is part of a developing movement in the American food industry. More bakers are returning to old food ways by trying to bake with whole grains. 100% organic whole grain is not only for making bread. Seilu also makes pastries using whole grains. Bethany said his work is easy because he surrounds himself with like-minded people, like his pastry chef, Charbel Abrash. But, Bethany said, Seilu would not work without the support of his business partner and wife, Jessica Aziz. Seilu's baked products are rich in natural minerals and vitamins, but the taste is what brings people back to the store. This makes Bethany happy because he wants people to eat food that is healthy for them, but still enjoyable. When you're going to a pastry shop or a bakery, there is excitement. I don't want to take away any of this experience, Bethany said. I'm Phil Dierking.
Amanda Green lives with pain. Green says her pain comes from lupus, an autoimmune disease that attacks her organs and tissues.
If I don't have nerve pain, I might have joint pain. If I'm not having joint pain, I might have headaches.
She tried taking medicine and other treatments, but she suffered an allergic reaction to opioids, a strong painkiller. Now Amanda Green is trying something different. It is called virtual reality therapy. Virtual reality, or VR, is growing in popularity in video gaming and some training programs. The person wears special equipment that covers the eyes. Inside, he or she sees images and hears sounds coming from a computer program. The experience makes people feel as if they are in the picture they are watching. For Green, virtual experience helped her feel more at ease and trained her to breathe in a special way. She saw a tree, crystals, and her breath as she was guided to breathe in and out.
It worked. It works for me.
Brennan Spiegel is a doctor who treats patients with stomach pain and intestinal problems. He says these disorders are sometimes connected to a person's mental health. VR can help, he explains, by changing the messages in the brain and nervous system. Spiegel is the director of health services research at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles, California. He heads Cedars-Sinai's virtual reality program, where more than 2,500 patients have been treated.
Virtual reality can reduce pain, can reduce blood pressure, and now we're looking to see, can it do really important things like reduce the need for opioids?
Opioid abuse has led to many deaths across the United States. But unlike opioids, Spiegel does not think patients seeking pain relief would become physically dependent on VR therapy. Researchers are looking at possible side effects. For some patients, less than 10%, they may feel off balance and sick to their stomach when wearing the VR headset.
Whoa.
That was one patient's reaction from his hospital bed after putting on a VR device. Spiegel said more than 100 hospitals nationwide are using VR to help patients control pain and nervousness. He added that more countries are taking an interest in VR, and doctors are beginning to develop policies on how to use the technology in healthcare. Swami Venuturupalli is a doctor and the founder of Attune Health, a center treating patients with autoimmune diseases. He is studying how visual technology can reduce the pain his patients feel. VR experiences may include swimming with dolphins and meditation exercises in front of a campfire. Venuturupalli says VR does more than just distract patients who are in pain. It can train them to learn deep breathing exercises, and it can help them with biofeedback, the ability to control things like heartbeat and brain waves with your mind. A business called Applied VR is testing virtual reality to see how it may help people deal with their pain. Its president, Josh Sackman, says his company is developing programs that will be helpful to patients of different ages, personalities, and interests. He says the goal is to create a VR pharmacy to serve them all. Sackman told VOA he has seen an improvement in the medical world's understanding of VR over the past 3 years. And he says, with patients using VR, you see a physical change in a short time as they go from someone in terrible pain, stressed, to relaxed. Brennan Spiegel says the aim is not to have the patients stay in their virtual world forever. The idea, he says, is for people to learn in VR that they can control their bodies and that the mind matters. And then people can use those skills when they need it in the real world. I'm Ann Ball. VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today, we are talking about Thomas Jefferson. Although he took office in 1801, he is still one of the country's best-known and most popular presidents. You can see a memorial honoring him in Washington, D.C. Jefferson is often linked to the country's history of self-government, separation of church and state, and public education. Over time, Jefferson's name also became linked to the continuation of slavery until the Civil War and to the loss of land for Native Americans. Jefferson was born in 1743 and grew up in the hills and low mountains of Virginia. His family's wealth enabled him to get an excellent education. Jefferson also learned to ride horses, dance, and explore the natural world. In the 1770s, Jefferson supported the American Revolution against Britain. He is probably most famous for being the lead writer of the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson went on to hold many positions in the country's new state and national governments. He served as governor of Virginia, a minister to France, secretary of state for President George Washington, and the vice president under President John Adams. Jefferson played an important part in the creation of the U.S., but he often wrote to friends about how he most wanted to retire from public service and return to his home in Virginia. In the 1760s, he designed a house there that he called Monticello. The word means little mountain in Italian. About 130 slaves lived on Monticello's grounds at any time. They worked in Jefferson's home, farms, and on special projects, such as making cabinets and nails. Jefferson owned about 600 slaves during his life, yet he said he disliked slavery. He believed God would judge slave owners severely. And, of course, Jefferson himself wrote in the Declaration of Independence, "All men are created equal and have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Yet, Jefferson did not use his political power to end slavery. He expected future generations would permit slavery to end slowly across the country. Jefferson's words and actions on slavery are contradictory. This conflict is especially evident because Jefferson likely had a long relationship with a slave at Monticello. Her name was Sally Hemings. Evidence suggests that Jefferson was the father of her six children of record. In 1801, Thomas Jefferson left Monticello to become the third U.S. president. His inauguration was the first held in Washington, D.C. Jefferson's government was a break from the earlier administrations. The first two presidents, George Washington and John Adams, supported a strong federal government. Jefferson, on the other hand, wanted to limit federal government. As president, Jefferson cut the national debt. He reduced the military. He disliked the power of the Supreme Court over the laws Congress made. And he rejected appearances that made the U.S. president look like a European king. One of the lasting images of Jefferson is of him receiving guests in old clothes and slippers. But as president, Jefferson also appeared strong and powerful when dealing with foreign nations. Jefferson increased American naval forces in the Mediterranean to guard against threats to American ships. And he permitted U.S. officials to buy a huge piece of land from France. Even though the Louisiana Purchase added to the national debt and exceeded the power the Constitution gave the president. In general, historians consider Jefferson's first term as president a success. Voters did too, because he easily won a second term. But those last 4 years were difficult. Jefferson's popularity suffered, especially when he stopped all American trade with Europe. Jefferson aimed to limit U.S. involvement in a war between Britain and France. Instead, critics say he ruined the American economy. Critics also attacked both Jefferson's political ideas and his personal qualities. George Washington worried that Jefferson would weaken the strong federal government he had worked hard to create. And even friends suggested in their letters that Jefferson was too idealistic. Jefferson's opponents also accused him of not being a Christian, although he said he was. However, he did not believe the government should make rules about religion. He wrote that the government should worry only about acts that hurt other people. He said, "It does not harm him if his neighbor says there are 20 gods or no gods. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." Jefferson's thinking on the separation of church and state remains important and, in general, popular in the U.S. today. However, Jefferson is linked to problems faced by Native Americans. He tried to get Indian nations to enter into treaties that ultimately took away their land. He wanted Native Americans to become more like European Americans. His policies made them depend on the federal government. And Jefferson took no major action to end slavery, either in his personal life or as a public official. At the end of his life, Jefferson wrote proudly about his accomplishments. He said he wanted to be remembered for three things: writing the Declaration of Independence, supporting religious freedom, and creating the University of Virginia. For the most part, he is. Jefferson also supported free public education, especially for those who could not pay for school. But his time at Monticello had many sorrows. His wife, Martha, had died in 1782 after difficulty in childbirth. Most of his children also died before him. In addition, the cost of improving and caring for Monticello, as well as the money he spent on fine wine and good food, had ruined him financially. Eventually, one of his daughters had to sell her father's beloved Monticello and the slaves who lived there to pay his debts. Jefferson died in his bed at the age of 83. The last detail of his life, which Americans love to tell, is that he died on America's birthday, exactly 50 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.